This lecture, entitled The Age of the Earth, Part 2, is dedicated in the honor and merit of Avraham Ben Moshe, Dr. Arnold Zura. In the previous lecture, we touched upon the various interpretations of the fossil record. Originally, during the 18th and early 19th centuries, the fossils and the sedimentary rock that contained them were widely viewed as being remnants of the Mabel, the great flood of Noah. Due to the great influence of Baron Georges Cuvier, the various strata containing fossils of extinct marine and land creatures were subsequently viewed as results of major catastrophic events unrelated to the Mabel, that violently buried these life forms, which occurred many years before the events recorded in the Torah. We quoted Dr. Thomas Chalmers, who, in order to resolve the seeming conflict between the biblical account and the scientific evidence, postulated that the first verse, Bereshis, in the beginning, is referring to a creation that occurred many years before the events described in the Torah. The second verse, and the land was empty and void, is referring to the current world, which began some 6,000 years ago. The Torah, however, did not reveal to us, according to Dr. Chalmers, the events that occurred between verse 1 and verse 2. And accordingly, this would account, therefore, according to this theory, for the fossils. For this reason, this interpretation is referred to by biblical scholars as the creation gap theory, the gap being between verse 1 and verse 2. We quoted from various sources that independently based themselves on Jewish tradition and not on the need to resolve the conflict between Torah and science, that support the idea that this earth is actually older than 6,000 years. And the suggestion of Rav Yisrael Lifshitz, the author of the Tiferes Yisrael, that perhaps these traditions will explain the fossil evidence. Before I continue with various sources that both confirm and contradict this approach, I would like to first explain how it became so widely accepted within the scientific world that the Earth is billions of years old. After all, no one is old enough to recall such events. They must have reconstructed this based on certain scientific assumptions. What are they? As we mentioned in the last lecture, the catastrophic interpretation of the fossil record, which was widely accepted during the 18th and up until the first third of the 19th centuries, was supplanted by a wholly different approach, that of what is called uniformitarianism. Uniformitarianism implies that the geological record was created not by catastrophe, such as sudden massive floods or the outpouring of lava, as the Earth suffered periodic convulsions, but by the same slow processes that we see today. In the words of the father of uniformitarianism, the 18th century Scottish geologist James Hutton, the present is the key to the past. And as whatever is happening now has always happened before. As we mentioned in the previous lecture, the man most responsible for the acceptance of this new paradigm was Charles Lyell, the 19th century author of the classic work on uniformitarianism, Principles of Geology. It was Lyell's work that most influenced Darwin to create his new theory on the origin of species. But it wasn't that Lyell had definitive proof that catastrophes never occurred, or what appears to be the work of massive catastrophe actually happened slowly over time. It was due to his total abhorrence of catastrophes and his ability as a lawyer to press his case despite its many weaknesses that he convinced a new generation of scientists that there is no reason to assume that anything out of the ordinary ever occurred. And what you find in terms of sediment and fossils is the product of what you are constantly viewing day in and day out. Slow sedimentation, erosion, and a slow lift and sinking of land. In Lyell's own words, This is taken from the Principles of Geology, the first volume, pages 317 to 318. I quote, "The earlier geologists had not only a scanty acquaintance with existing changes, but were singularly unconscious of the amount of their ignorance. With the presumption naturally inspired by this unconsciousness, they had no hesitation deciding at once that time could never enable the existing powers of nature to work out changes of great magnitude, still less such important revolutions as those which are brought to light by geology." And he continues on, "Never was there a dogma more calculated to foster indolence and to blunt the keen edge of curiosity than this assumption of discordance between the ancient and existing causes of change. It produced a state of mind unfavorable in the highest degree to the candid reception of the evidence of those minute but incessant alterations which every part of the earth's surface is undergoing. For this reason, all theories are rejected which involve the assumption of sudden and violent catastrophes and revolutions of the whole earth and its inhabitants. Theories which are restrained by no reference to existing analogies, in which a desire is manifested to cut rather than patiently to untie the Gordian knot." End quote. But as you clearly see in this brilliant display of hubris, he proved nothing, nor to even attempt to offer an explanation of phenomena that clearly were the products of catastrophes. In the words of the late paleontologist Stephen Jay Gould of Harvard, an article he wrote in September 1975 in Natural History, "Charles Lyell was a lawyer by profession, and his book is one of the most brilliant briefs ever published by an advocate." It continues on, "Lyell relied upon two bits of cunning to establish his uniformitarian views as the only true geology. First, he set up a straw man to demolish." Evidently, he overstated the position of the catastrophist. And they continues on, "In fact, the catastrophists were much more empirically minded than Lyell. The geological record does seem to record catastrophes. Rocks are fractured and contorted. Whole faunas are wiped out." And he continues on, "To circumvent this literal appearance, Lyell imposed his imagination upon the evidence." And then, secondly, "Lyell's uniformity is a hodgepodge of claims. One is a methodological statement that must be accepted by any scientist." In other words, you have to prove. In other words, you have to assume nothing happened unless, you know, there's really something dramatic to show you. This is catastrophists and uniformitarian alike. "Other claims are substantive notions that have since been tested and abandoned. Lyell gave them a common name and pulled a consummate fast one." End quote. The truth is that the evidence is abundant that there were massive catastrophes that resulted in wholesale deaths, which are recorded in the fossil record. In the year 1955, one of the great and controversial geniuses of the past century, Dr. Emanuel Velikovsky, published his work, Earth in Upheaval, arguing his case for a return to the catastrophic model in geology. Let me quote you from pages 17 and 18, Dr. Emanuel Velikovsky's classic work. Emanuel Velikovsky was an evolutionist. He was not a creationist. But his understanding of evolution is really closer to perhaps the current understanding of what's called this pulsated equilibrium, which there were massive changes that occurred over a very short period of time. That has as much problems, that theory, with the regular theory as well. But that was his position. We're not dealing with a religious person speaking. And I continue on. This section, which we're quoting on pages 17 and 18, deals with a red sandstone formation which forms the northern half of Scotland. In other words, if you go to Scotland today and start digging, in the northern half, you'd find red sandstone, which is beneath the soil. This area was investigated by the 19th century paleontologist Hugh Miller and the results were first published in his work entitled The Red Sandstone in 1841. So this is the background. In the words of Dr. Velikovsky, quote, "In the red sandstone, an abundant aquatic fauna is embedded. The animals are in disturbed positions. At the period of the past when these formations were composed," now is now quoting Hugh Miller, quote, from, "some terrible catastrophe involved in sudden destruction of the fish in an area at least 100 miles from boundary to boundary, perhaps much more. The same platform in Orkney as at," this is Cromarty, "is strewed thick with remains which exhibit unequivocally the marks of violent death. The figures are contorted, contracted, curved. The tail in many instances is bent around to the head. The spine stick out. The fins are spread to the full, as in fish that die in convulsions. The pterichthy," an extinct fish-like animal which was covered with bony plates, "shows its arms extended at their stiffest angle, as if prepared for an enemy. The attitudes of all the ichthyolites," which is, this means any fossil fish, "on this platform are attitudes of fear, anger, and pain. The remains, too, appear to have suffered nothing from the after attacks of predaceous fishes. None such seems to have survived. The record is one of destruction at once widely spread and total," end quote. This is from page 222 of Hugh Miller's Red Sandstone. And Dr. Velikovsky continues, "What agency of destruction could have accounted for, quote, innumerable existences of an area perhaps 10,000 square miles in extent being annihilated at once?" End quote from Hugh Miller. "Conjecture lacks footing in grappling with the enigma and expatiates in uncertainty over all the known phenomena of death," wrote Miller. And Velikovsky continues on, "The ravages of no disease, however virulent, could explain some of the phenomena of this area of death, this arena of death. Rarely does disease fall equally on many different genera at once, and never does it strike with instantaneous suddenness. Yet in the ruins of this platform, from 10 to 12 distinct genera and many species were involved, and so suddenly did the agency perform its work that its victims were fixed in their first attitude of surprise and terror," end quote. Today, geology has begun to move away from Lyell's orthodox uniformitarianism. Despite much resistance, it is commonly accepted today that the dinosaurs were wiped off the face of the earth through some sort of cataclysmic event, and many view the extinction of 95% of all of the species at the end of the Paleozoic era, which was at the end of the Permian period. This, the Paleozoic era is the era right before the age of the dinosaurs, as being the result of some sudden catastrophic event. Our own eyes have witnessed the power of just one volcanic eruption. In 1980, Mount St. Helens in Washington State erupted and created geological strata up to 600 feet high. Within 5 years, they had hardened to rock, all this mud. And they're striated, just like you'd see in the Grand Canyon. The volcano toppled 150 square miles of forest in 6 minutes. Its mud flow eroded a canyon system as deep as 140 feet. Later on, a small creek was found running through it. In other words, the mud flow really created, you know, this whole, you know, basically this whole system. And afterwards, it came out of a creek. Somewhere started running through it. As one author pointed out, had this eruption occurred a couple of centuries ago, where there were no eyewitnesses, a modern uniformitarian geologist inspecting these features might conclude that the strata had formed over eons. and the creek had carved out the canyon, similar to what they say about the Grand Canyon. Despite this criticism of Lyell, the fact is that Lyell's approach shaped the science of geology for well over a century and a half. It is Lyell, a full century before the science of radioisotope testing was well established, who bequeathed us the age of the fossils and life on Earth. How did he do it without any radioactive testing? And what assumptions did he work with? On pages 189 to 190 of Dr. Emanuel Velikovsky's work, Earth and Upheaval, he traces Lyell's methodology. And I quote, in 1829, Gerard Deset publishes studies on the fossiliferous strata in the Paris area, where marine animals alternate with land animals. In other words, you'll have a strata of marine animals, a strata of land animals. These strata disclose that in the upper marine bed were many kinds of shell-bearing mollusks that still inhabit the waters of the sea, and that the deeper the stratum, the fewer the living forms of mollusks. Following the publication of Deset's work, Lyell devised a timetable of geological ages. The fossilized remains of ancient animals indicate changes in fauna in the course of time. Lyell's measurement of geological periods is based on such changes in the animal kingdom, especially among the shell fauna. He found that there has been, in the Quaternary, or the age of man, not more than 1/20th of the evolution that has occurred since the Lower Miocene. That's a middle series of the Tertiary, the age of mammals. And we went through this before, but the history is really divided up, you know, into different periods. You know, you have the Paleozoic, you know, which ended on the end of the Permian era, where which the first reptiles appeared. Says we have the Mesozoic, which is the period of the dinosaurs. And afterwards, we have two periods. Which is really in the Cenozoic, the recent period. The first one is called the Tertiary, the third, and the one is the Quaternary, is the fourth. So the Quaternary is considered the age of man. So he found that the Miocene, we're going to go through this, but the Miocene, which is the middle of the Tertiary, he found that those found there were very, very different than the ones found higher up. So he figured they must have evolved or whatever. From that point on, he traced one complete cycle of what he called the cycle of evolution, during which, at his estimate, practically all species that existed in the opening of the cycle were replaced by new species. Thus, if a figure of a million years is accepted for the age of man, which started with the close of the Tertiary epoch, then 20 million years were needed to accomplish the changes observed since the Lower Miocene. And four such cycles of transformation of life forms must have passed since the end of the Mesozoic, or the age of reptiles. In other words, he kept on. There's a certain assumption, how long does it take to change? Even though absolutely no one knows how long anything is going to change. But that was this assumption. Well, then, if we assume equal time, by this method, Velikovsky continues, Lyell reckoned 12 cycles, or 240 million years, from the beginning of the Paleozoic, or the time of the early life forms on Earth. This figure is now considerably increased. Other figures are accepted at Lyell's valuation. So today, from the time of the beginning of the Paleozoic, the assumption, and the standard assumption by scientists, is like 550 million years. However, it says the other periods are basically Lyell's. Lyell's scheme, perfected by the introduction of new subdivisions of geological epochs, set forth the following rule. I mean, I'm quoting from Velikovsky. If a stratum contains 90 to 100% modern species of shells, the stratum is Pleistocene, or what is considered the Ice Age. If it contains 40 to 90% modern species of shells, the stratum belongs to the last subdivision of the Tertiary, the Pliocene. If only 20 to 40% of the shells in the stratum are present, a present-day varieties in the stratum is Miocene time, an earlier subdivision of a tertiary, and so on. Down to the stratum where shells of extant species of mollusks find no direct ancestors. Lyell's time system is based on the assumption that no catastrophic events intervened and that the extirpation of the species was a result of slow extinction, which Darwin's theory ascribes to the survival of the fittest in the struggle for the limited means of existence. But if great catastrophes occurred on the surface of the earth and the depths of the seas of more than local character, and if in such upheaval some forms of life perished and others survived, and the progeny of still others underwent strong mutations, I mean, this is his theory, Velikovsky's, that it was really through the radiation, his whole theory, I mean, this is really, earth and upheaval is part of his major theory, which began in his work called Worlds in Collision, that the world has come in contact with other bodies, which cause all these upheavals. And he maintained that it's quite likely that during these periods there was intense radiation. And it's these radiation that created the mutations that created all these life forms. Even though, as we've discussed before, mutations are really accidents, and it's hard to believe all these major accidents produce things of major organic systems that work so beautifully. And in terms of, he wasn't aware of really the code of the DNA when he wrote this. But basically, it's volumes upon volumes and volumes that are contained within the DNA. And all should be through the accident of mutation over an instant period of time. But that's really another whole discussion. But that is where Velikovsky's coming from. But the idea is, I mean, that there were just major catastrophes and major changes. And it's impossible to somehow predict or to say how long these occurred and over what period of time they occurred. And he continues on, then the entire scheme of percentages and time allotment by the multiplication of changes observed in the last epoch, with its preconceived plan and rigidity, is no more valid than the pronouncements of some theologians like Archbishop Usher of Ireland, who in 1654 declared that the creation took place at 9 o'clock in the morning on the 26th day of October, in the year 4004 before the Common Era. End quote. In attributing now to certain fossils to certain eras, Lyell also adopted the theories of William Smith, known as the father of stratigraphic geology, who believed that rock layers always occur in the same sequence depending on the type of fossils they contain. As you see, the whole dating method of the fossils, at least it was originally developed by Lyell, assumes some sort of natural evolutionary change. The fossil record is reflective of these changes. Till this day, for the most part, fossils are not dated by any radioisotopic method, but by the assumptions of evolutionary change. Although the original dates have been refined on the whole, when certain fossils are found, known as index fossils, also a concept developed by Smith, which are associated with a certain period, the date of the whole rock formation is assumed based upon Lyell's method. Only on relatively rare occasions where igneous volcanic rock, which contains radioactive isotopes, such as uranium-238 and 235, protrudes through the sedimentary rock, can any real testing of age be made. But often the results, if they do contradict the assumed evolutionary dates, are assumed to be somehow tainted and thrown out. To quote one source entitled The Age of the Earth, published by the Institute of Geological Sciences, this is quoted in a work called Shattering the Myth of Darwinism by Richard Milton on page 21, quote, where lavas or volcanic ashes are interbedded with sediment of known stratigraphic division, where an igneous rock intrudes one sedimentary unit and is blanketed by another, then the sediments may be dated from the igneous rock by inference. In other words, if there's igneous rock, in other words, from volcanic rock in the sediment, the fossils are contained in sedimentary rock. This is rock which is waterborne. So when we date through the radioisotopic method the rocks, and we want to say how much, you know, the percentage of how much uranium it contains versus lead or strontium. So when we measure that, it's volcanic rock. It's a different kind of rock. So it's really intruding inside this sedimentary rock. But it's assumed, well, if there's volcanic rock below it and volcanic rock above it, and this was put in the middle, well, this will have the same date, you know, of the rocks above it and below it. In other words, you assume if you start digging and you find volcanic rock, well, there must be a lava overflow. Below this, you find sedimentary rock. Well, it must have flown over the sedimentary rock. Below that, you find volcanic rock. Well, must be the sedimentary rock formed over the volcanic rock. First was the lower volcanic rock, and then the sediment came over millions of years and formed over that. And then there was another volcanic eruption, and now lava flowed again over this. So if I date the lava below it and the lava above this, well, then I have an idea when this sedimentary rock was formed. The rarity of such cases, together with analytical error, inherent age determination, means that the isotopic dates are unlikely to rival or replace fossils, and the most important means of correlation, end quote. In other words, for the most part, the belief in evolution is the reason these fossils are assumed to represent a certain level on the evolutionary chain and have a certain date. If one questions evolution uniformitarianism, then much of the whole time frame crumbles. In some of the previous lectures, we've pointed out some of the difficulties with the theory of evolution. And in subsequent lectures, we'll deal in greater detail with the evidence for catastrophic change. In this lecture, however, I would like to focus on the dating system, both from the viewpoint of the Torah as well as of that of science, especially as based upon the dating of unstable radioisotopes. Let me first explain the basis of radioisotopic dating. We know that the basic design of an atom is there exists a corresponding number of electrons, which are particles with a negative charge, electric charge, and protons, particles with a positive electric charge, in each element, with the electron circling or forming a field around the proton, which is in the middle in the nucleus of the atom. That's really the basis of the atom. There are 92 naturally occurring elements, each one following the same pattern. The largest naturally occurring element is uranium, which contains 92 protons and 92 electrons. But with the exception of the simplest atoms, hydrogen, whose nucleus only contains one proton, or really that's the simple, there's heavy hydrogen, which is different, but the simple, the most common form of hydrogen contains only one proton and, of course, one electron. But the nucleus of all of the other elements also contain neutrons, particles that weigh approximately the same as protons but carry no electric charge. I mean, basically, our understanding today of subatomic physics is that the proton, as well as the neutron, is a very complex particle. When I was growing up, you just thought of it as a push, like it's as simple as a neutron. As you learn a little more, there's nothing which is simple. Not in this, not in Gomorrah, there's nothing simple. And the proton really contain smaller particles. And a neutron really contains particles that contain both positive and negative elements, and that it holds it together. For instance, helium, which contains two protons and two electrons, also contains two neutrons in its nucleus. So although the atomic number of helium is 2, which represents the number of protons in its nucleus, the atomic weight of helium, the sum total of all its components, is approximately 4. Which is 2 protons and 2 neutrons. I mean, the electron, which also has a weight, is almost negligible. Now, helium has just as many protons as neutrons. There are other atoms which have more neutrons than protons. Some of them are stable, do not disintegrate, such as lead, whose atomic number is 82, which means it has 82 protons, but whose atomic weight is approximately 207. That means it has 82 protons and 125 neutrons. But not all lead has an atomic number of 207. Some have an atomic weight of 208, which means that it has 126 neutrons. Some has an atomic weight of 206, which means it has 124 neutrons. And some has an atomic weight of 204, which means it has 122 neutrons. All of these variations are known as isotopes, which means the same place in Greek. Iso means the same, and tope, like if you ever studied topography, or means place. As all these variations have the same atomic number, which represents the number of protons. So all there are differences on a theme. There are variations on a theme. The basic theme is the protons, the electron define the atom. But some of the isotopes of the elements are unstable, lose part of their nucleus at a predictable rate. This is known as radioactive decay. For instance, uranium, which has an atomic number of 92, meaning it has 92 protons in its nucleus, commonly has an atomic weight of 238, meaning it has 146 neutrons. Over time, the nucleus decays and gives off an alpha particle. An alpha particle is the equivalent of a helium nucleus, two protons and two neutrons. And converts to thorium with an atomic weight of 234. The thorium in turn decays, and its product in turn decays. Now finally, after losing eight alpha particles, what was formerly uranium-238 finally stabilizes and becomes lead-206. The time it takes for half of a group of atoms of an unstable element to decay is known as its half-life. Each radioactive element has a fixed rate of decay, which doesn't seem to be altered by pressure, heat, or magnetic fields. By measuring the relative amount of the parent or original element, such as uranium-238, and the daughter or derivative element, such as lead-206, in a mineral, and knowing its rate of decay, one can arrive at a date of the formation of the mineral. This is assuming, of course, that none of the daughter element was present when the mineral was formed, which is often not the case, nor easily testable. For instance, the half-life of uranium-238 is 4.5 billion years. Now, if you find a mineral that half of it is made up of uranium-238 and the other half is lead-206, there are grounds to say that the mineral containing these elements was formed 4.5 billion years ago. Assuming there was no lead-206 present when the mineral was originally formed. What we've just explained is an example of alpha particle decay, when two protons and two neutrons, equivalent to a helium nucleus, leave the atom. Another example of radioactive decay is what is known as beta decay. Alpha is, you know, in Greek, alpha is A, beta is B. That is when a non-stable neutron, because I said a neutron is complex, one that is made of a proton and electron, because an electron hits a proton and gets stuck, it neutralizes the charge, because part of it is positive and part of it is negative. It's like you're in a committee and you can't move, right? This one votes like this, and votes. So you have a neutron which is unstable. Now it ejects an electron, now turning the former neutron into a proton with a positive charge. An example of such radioactive decay is the isotope of carbon-14. Carbon-14 actually starts off in the atmosphere as nitrogen, an atom having 7 protons and 7 electrons. Upon being bombarded by cosmic rays, one of the protons in the nucleus of the nitrogen atom can turn into a neutron, actually the combination of an electron and a proton. Instead of 7 protons, there are now 6, because one of them has converted, you know, has been neutralized, just like the element carbon, and 8 neutrons. Now, since the nucleus, one of the protons has been neutralized, so only 6 those six can't hold seven electrons. So one of them is going to fly off. A carbon atom usually has six protons and six electrons with an atomic weight of 12. This new carbon, with its six protons and eight neutrons, has an atomic weight of 14. But it's unstable, unlike carbon 12. Over a period of approximately 5,700 years, half of all of the special neutrons of carbon 14 will lose an electron, an example, beta particle decay, and revert back to being the gas nitrogen with seven protons and seven neutrons. And will eventually float away. It turned into nitrogen. Can't stay there anymore. It'll capture another electron If you know the amount of carbon 14 in a sample, which you begin with, then you can easily calculate its date. Radioactive decay and radiometric measure of age, right, is a complex subject, but that's the basic theory behind this. And just as an aside, I remember Maria was taking a class, that we had a Geiger counter, and you can measure the amount of radioactive decay. For now, I believe these two examples will suffice, one example of alpha particle decay and one of beta particle decay. Later on this lecture, we will deal with yet another form of radioactive decay. Regarding carbon 14 testing, although it is used to date organic or carbon-containing material, its usefulness is limited as after some 50,000 years, because of the short half-life of carbon-14, there's almost no detectable carbon-14 left. And 5,700 years, you lose half. 5,700, you lose half of that. It keeps on that. However, going with the assumption 50,000 years ago, there was approximately as much carbon-14 in the atmosphere as there is now, scientists claim that they do have samples that are truly some 50,000 years old. Although carbon-14 dating cannot be used beyond 50,000 years, uranium, with a relatively long half-life, is used to date materials that are supposedly billions of years old. According to the dating system of uranium and other similar radioactive materials, the Cambrian age has been dated to 550 million years, and simple bacterial life has been dated to approximately 3.5 to 4 billion years. Based on comparative samples of meteors, the present estimation is that the solar system is some 4.5 billion years old. The universe as a whole is presently dated to some 15 billion years. It's based on other considerations in terms of the expansion of the universe. In the light of our current scientific understanding, how do we read the first chapter in Bereshit, in Genesis? In the previous lecture, we touched upon the opinion that the fossil record in the 4.5 billion years, as well as the 15 billion years of the universe, all occurred in the 6 days of creation, where time was measured by a different standard. We also quoted the opinion of those that maintain, although the statement Bereshit Bara Elokim, in the beginning, God created, is referring to events many billions of years ago, the 6 days of creation are dealing with events that occurred less than 6,000 years ago. Now, according to that, we would say that all of these, without challenging the assumptions, and we assume that the world is actually so old, but the Torah, this other approach, which we found in Christian circles by Dr. Thomas Chalmers, is assuming, though, that the Torah, dealing with the 6 days of creation, is only dealing with the last 6,000 years, and is not telling us about all that occurred before him. Rav Arya Kaplan, Olav Shalom, a blessed memory, discovered a manuscript written by one of the major Mekubolim, Kabbalists of the 13th to 14th centuries, Rav Yitzchok of Akko. In it, the author describes a time frame which is uncannily similar to what scientists presently consider to be the age of the world. Assuming that Rav Yitzchok was of the opinion this world is the last of seven worlds of creation, which we discussed in two previous lectures, about that there's cycles. In other words, we discussed about a cycle of 6,000 years and a seventh year, which is where the world is uninhabited. And we discussed this as part of a series, which is similar to the Jubilee series of seven sevens, or there would be seven 7,000-year periods, and the last would be, this last 1,000-year period would be the Jubilee year. And according to, and some have, as this is the Tiferes Yisrael, and we're going to discuss this, some have tried to explain the fossil evidence based on this. You know, that the fossil evidence is from the previous cycles. But according to Rav Yitzchok, he says that the worlds, these thousands of years that are discussed, these worlds were measured in God's time, not ours. Rav Aryeh Kaplan wanted to use this Kabbalistic text as an answer to the apparent contradiction between science and Torah. With this introduction, I would like to now go through this shita, this opinion, as well as others' opinions that have been brought forward to clarify this issue about the nature of the 7 days, as well as the notion that there existed previous worlds. And if you have on your handout, I'm giving you a handout here, we quoted in the last lecture, and about just the idea of time being different. And one of the quotations, even though it is a from the Sefer Bereishis Rabosi, from Moshe Hadarshan, which is quoted by Rav Kasher in the Torah Shlema, is that it was evening and it was morning one day. I'm quoting from the Sefer Bereishis Rabosi. This refers to the 1,000 years which are considered one day in the eyes of God, as it is stated, for 1,000 years in your sight are but like yesterday. There's a question how to understand this. Does it mean, is he just really alluding to what the medieval commentators, the Ramban, the Rabbeinu Bachya, say, that there's a correlation between the 6 days of creation and what occurred then and the subsequent thousands of years of real history? And basically all they're just saying is that the correlation exists because, you know, in God's time, so a day would be considered 1,000 years. And he goes through the correlation of what occurred during these periods. Like in the fourth day, the luminaries were created. So during this fourth time, there was an upsurge of Torah. And or it could be understood literally that the 6 days of creation were actually longer periods of time. And with that, I would like to introduce now, here this is from the manuscript of Yitzchak of Akko. And I quote, I, the young man Yitzchak of Akko, having seen fit to put down in writing a great secret, Kabbalistic teaching, which is befitting to keep well hidden. You should know that a day of the Holy One, blessed be He, is the equivalent of 1,000 of our years, as it is stated, for 1,000 years in your sight are but like yesterday. Our years are made up of 365 1/4 days. Accordingly, the year in the world above is equal to 365,250 of our years. 2 years in the world above would then be the equivalent of 725,500 of our years. Based on this, if we continue to convert our years into heavenly years through the process of multiplication, we come to the following conclusion. Again, he's assuming now the idea of 49,000 years of world history. And then in the heavenly world, it would be the 49,000 of our years, which are made up of 365 1/4 days, each day of which is 1,000 years in heaven, can be converted into, he doesn't say the number, but you can calculate, it would come out into 17,897,250,000 years. And this is 17 billion, almost 18 billion years. This is alluded to in the verse, and the Lord alone shall be exalted on that day. Who can utter the mighty acts of the Lord? This is like it's something beyond us. Blessed be the name of the glory of His kingdom forever. Everything will be as stated in Scripture. The form that it takes, however, will be many times over. Thousands of thousands of thousands have no value in His eyes. They are like but an instant. The Creator is the eminent Tzaddik with the Ein Sof, and this is a Kabbalistic description of God, the Infinite One. It is simply sufficient to say there is no end. And he continued, the proof of the existence of the world for a great many years, so many that the one would have become exhausted calculating them, is a statement of Yeshaya Hanavi, of blessed memory, who said, for the child shall die 100 years old. Just as we now remark about a 3-year-old child or less who dies, a child just died. So too in the future we remark about a 100-year-old person who dies, a child just died, due to the immensity of years the people will live. But basically he's describing life after our life. If those of diminished faith challenge you and deny the strange thing, tell them that such things have happened before. Methuselah, Methuselah, lived for almost 1,000 years, less some 30. Certainly in his lifetime, if a person lived to be 100 then died, Methuselah would say about him, he died merely as a child. Now our eyes are seeing that the existence of the world is very long, in contradistinction to those who say the existence of this world is only 49,000 years, which is 7 Shemitahs. I mean, when you read this, though, you get the impression, not necessarily that this is, we're living in the middle of this, but we're living really in the beginning of this. But according to Rav Arya Kaplan, the last of these cycles, our cycles, the 6,000 years would be understood literally, even though we don't see any distinction in the text of Rav Yitzchak of Akko. Accordingly, the first 6 of the cycles, which were measured in Hashem's time frame, would have lasted 15,340.5 million years, almost exactly the equivalent to current scientific thinking. So with this, Rav Arya Kaplan wanted to, you know, take this and borrow this, so to speak, and assume, if one assumed that this is the last of the cycles, that the previous cycles may have lasted many, many years before. Maybe. But that is the approach that is taken that assumes that the worlds before us, not only there were worlds before us, but they lasted a longer time. Or according, it would also be according to those, you know, who assume that the 6 days of creation were days of great upheaval, which we've discussed in the previous lecture, but which put those days much longer than ours. However, of course, that there's a whole body of thought that assumes the 6 days of creation were literally days. And here in your on the handout on page 2, which we quoted in the last lecture, that it seems that that in the creations of the first day, the measure of day and the measure of night were also created, which seems to be understood that really was the same measure we have today was created then. The original day was 24 hours, just as all of the other subsequent 6 days of creation. We find a medrash as well, which would assume, even though we've discussed the idea of previous worlds, and there is midrashic support for this, but that is not the only opinion. For instance, here on top of page 3, this is the Medrash Bereishis Rabbah. This is from the first chapter, the third paragraph. Rabbi Liana ben Tavrin said in the name of Rabbi Yitzchak, both Rabbi Hanina and Rabbi Yochanan agree that the angels were not created the first day. This Rashi quotes this in Chumash. This is so that people should not say that the angel Michal pulled the heavens towards the south, Gavriel pulled towards the north, and God fitted in the middle. Rather, I am the Lord who makes all things, who stretches the heavens alone, who spreads abroad the earth by myself. This is a verse in Isaiah, Yeshayahu, in the 44th chapter. Myself was with, who was with me, who was a partner with me in the creation of the world. In other words, God was alone the first day. Angels were created the second day. Well, if angels were not created yet, it would be very strange that there were so many cycles of thousands of years on life on this planet and no angels. I mean, it's understood that this is, even if one would believe in cycles and the idea of these repeated cycles of 6,000 years and the 7,000 years of rest adding to the Yovel cycle, but this would be the first, if they would agree to this. Of course, that whole idea of multiple worlds, I guess, is very controversial. I mean, it seems, again, even if we'd say that there's a machlokas, there is an argument between this. Which we quoted in a previous lecture here, this is on paragraph C on page 3. This is from the Sefer Mamor of Shimon Bar Yochai from Reb Chaim Vital, in the name of the Arizal, which was the preeminent Kabbalist. Regarding this in general, I would like to tell you about an error which crept into the writings of some of the Kabbalists, such as the Sefer HaKona and the work of the author of Sefer HaTemuna, who state that there will be 7 Shemitahs in the world. Every period of 7,000 years corresponds to 1 Shemitah, and that 1 Shemitah has already elapsed, and we are in the 2nd Shemitah, which hints to the Sefer of Sphira of Gevura, of might, differently than the first one, which was Chesed, which was kindness, similar things upon which they elaborated, which are not so. I am now telling you not to believe such things. We touched upon it in the first lecture when we first quoted this of this series about just the question is how to view the words of Reb Chaim Vital in the name of the Arizal. Do we view them as all quoted ultimately from Eliyahu HaNavi and they're infallible, or that they are the result, at least partially, of the wisdom of the Arizal? And of course, we quoted from many other sources, which do, and it seems Midrashic sources as well, which seem to assume that there were previous worlds. But about all of this, I would like to, before we begin the next section, I would like to quote here from the Netziv. This is Anatoly Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the Rosh Hashiva of Volozhin, who was the foremost scholars in the 19th century, and in his commentary on the Chumash, the Hamikdavar, he says the following. This has to do describing the flood, and every living creature was destroyed. Describing the flood, the usage of the word vayimach carries with the implication that creatures were nimche, dissolved. The bodies were dissolved. The verse is precisely worded, which was upon the face of the ground. Only those who were lying upon the ground became dissolved. There were, however, many bodies that remained whole, as much earth fell on them through the force of the water, and the bodies remained whole. These are the bones which are found by those who dig up the earth, bones of animals who no longer inhabit this world. Based on these finds, many have come to the conclusion there existed a world before this creation, which was occupied by different creatures. In other words, he's quoting now the idea of the multiple worlds, like Tiferes Yisrael. And he assumes that there are many, evidently just not Rabbi Yisrael Lipschitz, the author of Tiferes Yisrael, but many scholars maintain this view. He disagrees with it. The truth is that in the Medrash Bereishis Rabbah, on numerous occasions, the Medrash quotes the following explanation. One of the times that this Medrash appears is a commentary on the verse in Genesis 1:31, and behold, it was very good. This teaches the Holy One, blessed be, he created worlds and destroyed them and said, this one pleases me and this one does not, end quote. There are similar statements in the Holy Zohar, Vayikra, on the verse, and if his offering is a sacrifice, a peace offering. In other words, he maintains that he is of the opinion that there were previous worlds. And there were previous lifetimes that were obliterated. But he continues on, nevertheless, I find it difficult to say that the creatures that were discovered were remnants of a previous world, because it is clearly stated in Shemos Rabbah, Parsha Lamed, these are the generations of heaven and earth. What did the verse mean to negate by saying these? For he would create worlds and look at them, and they were not pleasing to them, and he returned them back to the state of tohu vavohu. And as he's quoting this Medrash, void and empty. And he's understanding the word void and empty means totally obliterated to the extent that there's no remnant left. If that is the case, then absolutely nothing was left of them. It would seem, however, that these bones are the remnants of those creatures who lived before the Mabul. In other words, he does not disagree. He is of the opinion in the Netziv that there were multiple worlds before. And maybe perhaps if he would deal with the evidence in terms of the radioisotopes and say that the world is 4.5 billion years old, maybe it's from the previous worlds. He's just saying no life. As it was tohu vavohu, everything was blotted out. So there are no remains. Even though they are found in climatic zones which these animals don't live, this is due to the fact that they change their nature before the Mabul and travel to another place. The world was a different place beforehand, but he's of the opinion the fossil evidence is the evidence of the life within the last 6,000 years before the flood. This is the Netziv. Just as a problem of his interpretation, though, he's assuming tohu vavohu means totally nothing, which would be similar, perhaps, to the Ramban's view. The tohu is this, as we discussed in the previous lecture, tohu is the heyuli, is this first energy source, and vohu is the very first form of matter, but basically something very unlike what we have today. But we've quoted before the Targum Yerushalmi. This is to the in the beginning, on the verse, the world was tohu vavohu. He explains it was void and empty, void of people, empty of livestock. It's not a description of how bad it was or things were totally, that there's like a whole new world. It just means to say it was an empty world. And the spirit of godly compassion swept upon the face of the earth, of the waters, and really from that it would seem to indicate, on the contrary, that what was here before still remained. It was just empty of life. That's all it meant. And we've quoted at least a supportive statement, which had to be interpreted differently. There's a Gemara in Chagiga, in Tezayin Omed Aleph, in 16a, which says that why God doesn't want us to speak about what happened before creation, not allowed to talk about it, we have no idea, there's no indication of it, is because it's akin to a king who builds a palace on a garbage dump. And doesn't feel comfortable when he's asked, what did you build it on? He likes to describe, you know, the windows, the tapestry, the glass. He doesn't want to talk about what's below the foundation, which was this ashpa, which was his garbage heap. But it would seem to indicate this world is built on a garbage heap, which supports this idea about previous worlds and the fossil evidence being the evidence of these previous worlds. However, having said that, the Netziv, though, is of the opinion that all remains that we have are of the last 6,000 years. And of course, according to the Arizal, who maintains that any previous worlds were in a spiritual state and not a physical state, the remains would have to be of the last 6,000 years. In the Christian world, just as in the Jewish world, there are many people who believe in the literal truth of the Bible and find it hard to justify many of the explanations, how brilliant they may be in the light of the simple meaning of the text. They also find it difficult to attribute all of the fossil evidence to previous worlds, in that it leaves almost no record of the devastation that must have occurred in the wake of the Mabel, Noah's flood. In 1962, theologian John Whitcomb and hydraulic engineer Henry Morris launched what became the creation science movement with their publication of their book, The Genesis Flood. In that work, which relies to a large degree on Christian sources for its biblical interpretation, the authors articulate a well-reasoned scientific approach to explain why the majority of the fossil evidence is the result of the tremendous cataclysms that occurred in the wake of the Mabel. Since the publication of that work, Henry Morris went on to found, together with Dr. Duane Gish, the Institute for Creation Research, which has produced over the years many well-researched and well-reasoned works. Because of their firm roots in Christian fundamentalism, their works have only had a limited impact outside evangelical Christian circles. It was only after the publication of Michael Denton's Evolution of Theory in Crisis and Philip Johnson's Darwin on Trial and the founding of the Intelligent Design Movement that the notion that Darwin's theory of evolution is seriously flawed receive a wider audience. On one issue, though, the scientific creationists and intelligent design people part company, and that is on the age of the earth and the role of the Mabel, the flood, in creating the fossil record. One prominent person in the Jewish world who articulated the stance of the scientific creationists was the late Rabbi Avigdor Miller, Zatzal. Not only did he passionately critique the theory of evolution, he also embraced the literal view of the creationists and pointed out the difficulties of the uniformitarian position. In the coming lectures of this series, where appropriate, we will continue to touch upon those difficulties. But in this lecture, I would like to concentrate on the evidence that the creationists have presented that on the whole not only undermines the evolutionary position, but also points to creation that came into existence far shorter than the billions of years that is commonly accepted. In order to better remember the points we will be making, I have arranged them in a mnemonic. Since so many of those who have embraced the atheistic revolutionary view of the world have done so with what one can only be described as avodah zarah, a foreign religious passion, the university and the Museum of Natural History as the new church, and the evolutionary scholars as their priests and ministers, to describe the difficulties, it would be best as the difficulties associated with this modern day avodah zarah. I've chosen to use the mnemonic, therefore, some church. Because of the time constraints in this lecture, we will cover the subject alluded to in the acronym SUM. In the next lecture, we will cover the inyonim, those subjects which are alluded with the acronym CHURCH. This treatment, by the way, is not exhaustive, but rather gives you some inkling into the literature of the scientific creationists and their arguments. So as you'll see for yourself, some of the arguments are more compelling than others. The S of some church stands for sun. The sun, as you know, is constantly losing both energy and mass as it burns. At what rate? In the September 1979 issue of Physics Today, the following was reported, quote, "By analyzing data from Greenwich Observatory in the period from 1836 to 1953, John A. Eddy, of the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics and the High Altitude Observatory in Boulder, Colorado, and Aram A. Bournazian, a mathematician with S. Ross and Company in Boston, have found evidence that the sun has been contracting about 0.1% per century during that time, corresponding to a shrinkage rate about 5 feet per hour. And digging deep into historical records, Eddy found 400-year-old eclipse observations that are consistent with such shrinkage. Creation point out that at that rate, 100,000 years ago, the sun would have been twice its size, making life at that rate, says, untenable. Eddy eventually lowered his estimates from 5 feet an hour to 2 feet an hour, but it seems still too fast for Darwinian evolution to have occurred. Evolutionists, in their defense, have argued, since evolution is a proven fact, I mean, that's what they assume, the reported shrinkage must be either A, temporary, B, cyclical, or C, the observations were faulty. Creationists understand and view this as evidence that the Earth must be quite young. In other words, if the world is not many millions or billions of years, then the theory of evolution cannot adequately explain life on Earth. So again, just giving you a taste of some of their arguments. This takes now to the O of some church, which stands for order. The basis for the evidence of evolution in the geological record is the assumption that each fossil level represents many millions of years in the making and is ordered chronologically according to when they were formed and laid down. The Precambrian rock is, of course, at the bottom and are followed by the various periods of Paleozoic era, first the Cambrian, then the Ordovician, Silurian, Devonian, then the Carboniferous, which is subdivided, the first the Mississippian, then the Pennsylvanian, and finally the Permian periods. All told, the Paleozoic era is supposed to have lasted some 300 million years. On top of the layers which make up the Paleozoic era are those of the Mesozoic era. First the Triassic period, when the age of the dinosaurs began, then the Jurassic, remember Jurassic Park, and then the Lower Cretaceous and the Upper Cretaceous when the dinosaurs came to an end. All told, the Mesozoic era lasted some 200 million years. And this is according to the standard dating. The layers upon them represent the various periods and epochs of the Cenozoic, which is in turn divided into first the tertiary, which we discussed before, and literally the third period, which is subdivided into first the Paleocene. By the way, Charles Lyell is credited to have given these names. And then the Eocene, Oligocene, Miocene, and finally Pliocene. Above the tertiary is the quaternary, literally the fourth period when man first makes his appearance. This is divided into first the Pleistocene and then the Holocene. All told, the Cenozoic is supposed to have lasted some 65 million years. Since each system is supposed to have deposited sediment, because according to uniformitarian theory, the sediment is constantly building up, millimeter on top of millimeter, over millions and millions of years, you expect to find all of the various systems, one on top of each other. The truth is that it is not so. In the words of a creationist geologist, Stephen Austin, on page 24 of his work, Grand Canyon, Monument to Disaster, I quote, "The notion that the Earth crust has an onion skin structure with successive layers, can all strata systems distribute on a global scale, is not according to the facts. Data from continents and oceans basins show that the 10 systems are poorly represented on a global scale. Approximately 77% of the Earth's surface area on land and under the sea has seven or more, means 70% or more, of the strata systems missing beneath." They only have 30% of them. 94% of the Earth's surface has three or more systems missing beneath. An estimated 99.6% has at least one missing system. Only a few locations on Earth, about 0.4% of its area, have been described with a succession of the 10 systems beneath. If you want to know, if you want to look into it, it's West Nepal, West Bolivia, and Central Poland. I guess there's no travel agents here, so... yeah. Yeah. The entire geological column composed of complete strata systems exists only in the diagrams drawn by geologists, end quote. The Grand Canyon, for instance, contains only five of the major systems. But what happened to all those missing layers? Geologists attribute it to erosion. But according to the creationist scientists, signs of erosion are often missing. And many find it difficult to understand how erosion, which is generally a slow process, could have totally erased time and time again solid rock layers which were built over tens of millions of years. But what is more disturbing and goes to the root of the whole theory is how is it that hundreds and hundreds of locations, the geological strata, are out of order? Although conventional geologists attribute this reversal of order to seismic activity, where the different layers folded and moved, often older layers moving over younger layers. The problem is, although very often there are signs of such activity, on other occasions there's absolutely none. And yet the strata are still out of order. For creationists, the whole idea that whole rock formations, which occupy hundreds or even thousands of square miles, could have moved or slipped on top of the younger strata, there's basically, you have a problem. Just explain this. On a very simple level, assuming that these strata were created over time. So I have something of the Paleozoic era should be on the bottom and the Mesozoic era on top. But yet if I find them reversed, you say, how did that happen? You can design. So they have a brilliant, people involved. And they came up with at least one of the solutions is as follows. We have a situation here for 10 where the paleo, you have two sides. One has Paleozoic and Mesozoic the way it should be. The other one had a Paleozoic that got all eroded. On top of it was a Mesozoic. So we have a Mesozoic on top over here, and we have a regular one. So on the left side I have Mesozoic on top, Paleozoic on the bottom. On the right side, I just have a Mesozoic, because the Paleozoic got eroded way before. Now, on the left side, this is where I have this Mesozoic. There was earthquake the Paleozoic. Now the Mesozoic got eroded. So on the right side, now I have side by side, I have Paleozoic. On the right side, I have Mesozoic. There was a big earthquake. And it got the one side, the left side got, which was the Paleozoic, got thrust up and moved and slided over the Mesozoic. So now I have the Paleozoic on top and the Mesozoic on the bottom. A lot of things happened. You see, you should have expected a lot of crushed rock over there. So this is, but yet you go and there's no crushed rock. So there's a problem. They've had, how could it move? How did it move hundreds of miles? And there should be, says how, there should be some sign of this. But he says, and such movements, it's unknown in our experience. I mean, that itself should be a testament to great cataclysms. A regular earthquake, you saw the San Francisco, it was Gomish, you know, a little bit here, a little bit there. You have something which moves whole rock layers 100 miles. According to the creationists, all the strata were laid down at the time of the Mabul, the flood, and are all contemporaneous. The lower strata represents the least mobile of the animals, such as the invertebrates that could not escape, the inevitable burial that accompanied the terrible mudslides, another phenomena. The higher animals were the most mobile, since were generally buried later. In this manner, layer formed upon layer, generally in this fashion, but with many exceptions, that it could have happened, hence the reverse order at times. Because of the time restrictions, when we study Mirtz Hashem, the Mabul, as we will get into the subject in greater detail. So the S is sun. The sun seems to be shrinking, which basically would assume that in not so long ago, the sun was really too large to for life to have existed here. And the second is order, which they maintain the whole basis of the theory of evolution and the whole basis of the dating of the earth is the assumption that we have the older layers on the bottom and the newer layers on top. If somehow, if you even found only one instance that this is not true, that one could not explain through seismic activity, that itself disproves the whole thing. Even if you had one, there are hundreds and hundreds of these cases. If you can find one, you got real problems. But that's the O. I'm just going to get familiar with the literature of the creationists. This is the O of some church. Now that we takes us to the M. The M stands for magnetism. The earth is a giant magnet, but the intensity of its magnetic field seems to be decreasing. In 1967, the U.S. Commerce Department published a detailed scientific study of the magnetic field, showing that its intensity has diminished 7% since first measured in 1829. The report predicted that if the decay continued at the same rate, the Earth's magnetic field would vanish by the year 3991. Don't worry. Yeah. In the December 1989 issue of the Scientific American, they write, quote, "In the next two millennia, if the present rate of decay is sustained, the dipole component of the field should reach zero." End quote. Even though there is evidence of a fluctuation of this rate in the past, the field does seem to be weakening. This implies that the magnetic field was stronger in the past. According to creation scientist Dr. Russell Humphreys, a physicist at Sandia National Laboratories, even taking into account past fluctuations, the magnetic force may limit the Earth's age to approximately 10,000 years. Beyond that, because of the intensity of the field, will be impossible to live. Of course, the world could be would conceivably be younger. Creation scientists view this as evidence of the relative young age of the Earth. Again, I just want to give you a sense of where they come from. Of course, their voice is rarely ever heard. Now this takes to the E of some church, which is the last thing which we will be discussing in this lecture, which is eruption. Besides for the original dating system founded by Lyell, based upon the suggested time for the change from one species to another, and the sedimentation rate, as we stated before, fossils are also dated by the rare occurrence of igneous or volcanic rock, which may be present below or above certain fossils, which by carefully measuring the ratio between the parent and the daughter radioactive isotopes, a supposedly accurate age of the rocks surrounding the fossil can be ascertained, which we discussed before. In theory, it is a very compelling argument. In practice, however, whenever the system has been tested against dates or independently known, it has failed miserably. We previously discussed dating using uranium-238 and comparing to the byproduct lead-206. Another one of the major radioisotope dating systems is that of potassium-40, which partially converts over time to argon-40. Potassium has 19 protons and electrons. Potassium-40 has, in addition, 21 neutrons and is not stable. Over time, 89% of this potassium-40 converts into calcium-40, a very stable element, which has exactly 20 protons and 20 neutrons. This happens when one of the neutrons in the potassium-40 releases a beta particle, an electron, converting the former neutron into a proton. We discussed it by carbon-14. And thereby converting the potassium into calcium. However, in 11% of the time, one of the protons in the nucleus of the potassium-40 captures an electron, converting into a neutron and thereby becoming argon-40. With 18 protons and 22 neutrons. By comparing the amount of argon-40 with the original potassium-40, the age of the mineral can be arrived at, and as we can determine what the half-life is, it is assumed that the argon-40, which is a gas, became trapped in the crystal structure of the mineral, and by measuring it, one could have an accurate picture of how much potassium was converted to the gas. One cannot underestimate the role that potassium-40 has played in dating the age of fossils and confirming the evolutionary thesis. For instance, the dating of the fossil finds of Richard Leakey and Donald Johnson of those promite, remember Lucy? Dating the thing? So of these primates, which are supposedly the evolutionary links between apes and man, were dated primarily using potassium-argon method. By dating the compacted volcanic ash, or tuff, that was found at Lake Turkana in Kenya, where these fossils were found. Critics of this method claim that since argon-40 is so pervasive in the Earth's crust, argon is the 12th most abundant chemical on Earth, could very well be that the argon that is measured is not a daughter product of the disintegration of the potassium, rather was always there to begin with. If this is the case, then the whole method is left in doubt. But let me quote to you from pages 47 and 48 of the book, Shattering the Myths of Darwinism by Richard Milton. So if radiogenic argon-40 is like a bird in a cage, you know, it's captured, then it is a cage that already contains birds of the same feather, from which it is indistinguishable. The possibility of anomalous inclusion of argon is not merely conjecture, but borne out by numerous studies of volcanic rocks that resulted in false dates. Even modern volcanic lava found in recent historical times have been dated up to 3 billion years old. This is by the potassium-argon method. According to Noble and Naughton, this is quoting of the Hawaiian Institute for Geophysics, in an article by them in October 1968 issue of Science magazine, quote, "The radiogenic argon and helium contacts of three basalts erupted into the deep ocean from an active volcano," this is Kilauea, "have been measured. Ages calculated from these measurements increase with sample depths up to 22 million years for lavas deduced to be recent. Caution is urged in applying dates from deep ocean basalts and studies on ocean floor spreading," end quote. A similar study of Hawaiian basaltic lava actually dated from eruption 1801 near Hulali came up with potassium-argon dates ranging from 160 million years to 3 billion years. This was published in the July 1960 issue of the Journal of Geophysical Research. In 1969, McDougall of the Australian National University measured the ages of lava in New Zealand and got an age of 465,000 years, whereas the carbon dating of wood included in the lava showed out to be less than 1,000 years old. The suspected reason for the anomalous age was the incorporation of environmental argon-40 at the time of eruption and the inheritance of argon-40 from the parent magma. I would just like, because of the late thing, I'll just skip some of this. But creationists claim this indicative that the whole system is unreliable. In the next lecture, we'll go further examples of the unreliability of radiometric dating. But there's yet another aspect of ephyr eruption. So one is the whole dating system. Whenever they have something that they have certain dates, they say there's a problem. You know, so you wonder, then why keep the whole method? Because really that is, this method is really the underpinning of the whole theory of evolution. And if you stop believing in evolution, you'll have to start keeping Shabbos. You know, so it's tough. Right? Yeah. But there's yet another aspect of the Ephor eruption which supports the catastrophic or young earth view. And that is the evidence of massive eruptions in the past on a level which is unparalleled in our times. Today's volcanoes seem to be only a vestige of the cataclysmic events that once tore apart the world. I'll just read from some of this. Okay. This is from Earth and Upheaval on page 134. A great chain of volcanoes girdles the Pacific Ocean. The Andes in South America are studded with many volcanic summits. Among them, the loftiest volcanic mountains in the world. This is Cotopaxi in Ecuador, is over 19,000 feet high. The Andes reached their present height only in the age of modern man. Because we know that there are cities there that are unlivable. And we know that they planted crops which can't be planted now. So this is really in modern times that really the whole Andes was uplifted. Magma intruded into the rock and lifted it. In many places, magma reached the surface, broke through vents, and built craters. Most of these volcanoes, however, are already extinct. Because they used to be active, now they're extinct. Central America abounds in volcanoes, most of them extinct or dormant. The highest, Orizaba in Mexico, over 18,000 feet high, was active for the last time 3 centuries ago. United States, few volcanoes are active, though many have become extinct very recently. The geological sense, Alaska, the Aleutian Islands, the Kamchatka Peninsula, and the Kuril Islands encircle the northern Pacific with a volcanic arc. The Japanese islands contain volcanoes by the score. Most of them are extinct, some only recently so. For most of the Philippines, the so-called volcano islands, one which is Iwo Jima, this is the Moluccas, northern New Zealand, the Sunda, this is archipelago, all are crowded with volcanoes, most of them only recently this extinct. In the center of this chain are the Hawaiian Islands with 15 great mountainous volcanoes, all extinct or dormant except Mauna Loa and Kilauea, two of the largest volcanoes on Earth. And he quotes here from this book Daily, Our Mobile Earth. How was that 30,000-foot cone built from the floor of the deep sea? I mean, it was an amazing... When in 1855 Mauna Loa erupted, the lava ran over the land at a velocity of 40 miles an hour faster than a swift horse. In 1883, when the volcanic island of Krakatoa and the Sunda Strait blew off, it sent a column of pumice and ashes over 17 miles high. It raised tides 100 feet high that carried steamships miles inland and were felt on the eastern coast of Africa and the western coast of the Americas as far as Alaska. It created a noise that was heard in Ceylon, the Philippines, even Japan, over 3,000 miles away. This would compare with an explosion in London heard in New York. When Bondi, says, erupted in Japan in 1888, it cast almost 3 billion tons of material and blew off one of its 4 peaks. But these delayed actions of single volcanoes look like child's play, but the forces that in past ages thrust up the Andes, spread the Deccan Trap, the great lava flows several thousand feet thick, that cover 250,000 square miles in India, built the lava dikes that cross South Africa and spread the Columbia Plateau in America and laid the lava bed of the Pacific. Basically, he's saying that there were tremendous volcanic action, and what we say now is only the Shirayim, really is only left over as we see one, this is in historic periods, all of these old volcanoes becoming extinct. Referring to the Patagonia, volcanic eruptions have occurred down to fairly recent times, and the land between the Atlantic and the Andes is covered in many places with lava flows. All in all, only about 400 or 500 volcanoes on Earth are considered active or dormant against a multiplicity of extinct cones. Yet only 500 or 600 years ago, many of the presently inactive volcanoes were still active. This points to very great activity at a time only a few thousand years ago. All at the rate of extinction witnessed by modern man, the greater part of the still active volcanoes will become inactive in a matter of several centuries. What caused such volcanic activity in the often of colossal proportions and even its eventual cessation in the future? It all points to some cataclysmic event. According to the creationists, that event was the Mabul, the Great Flood. Some 4,000 years ago, which was the cause of much of the scarring and sedimentation of the earth and the burial of the fossils. The purpose of all of this is to acquaint you with the creationist view, a view, although at odds with the generally accepted scientific paradigm, is nonetheless also based on scientific evidence, as well as the traditional simple meaning of the biblical text. Although there are other approaches to resolve the commonly accepted scientific dating system in the Torah, such as the novel definition of each day of creation, or the creation gap theory, approaches that are embraced by many of the Orthodox Jewish community, I believe that anyone who chooses to embrace the traditional approach can do so without the misgivings of having been proven wrong by the scientific evidence. As you see, there's much to be said for the traditional approach. At this point, I'd like to stop for questions. In the next lecture, which is part three of the age of the earth, we'll continue to present more evidence to support the belief in a young earth that's measured in thousands and not billions of years, and complete the acronym, SUM Church. We're all set? Okay, good to go.